the National Archives podcast series, The Bells of Belfast, presented by Rudy Newman.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. This year, this very day, is the centenary of a world-changing incident, one never far from the public eye even after 100 years, part of our very culture. An almost legendary event that, to many, took barely 3 hours to occur, but in reality spanned more than a decade and has yet to reach a final conclusion. I am honoured to be invited here today to the National Archives to present a whistle-stop history of the Royal Mail steamships Olympic, Titanic and Britannic. The Edwardian Mercantile Marine was dominated by two great shipping companies, the Cunard Steamship Company and the Steam Oceanic Navigation Company. Commonly known under the name of the White Star Line, it was created in 1869 by Thomas Henry Ismay, who purchased the bankrupted White Star for £1,000, backed by Harland & Wolff Shipyard of Belfast. In 1899, Thomas Ismay died, the business transferring to his son, Joseph Bruce Ismay. In 1902, White Star was purchased for some $32 million, approximately £10 million, by financier John Pierpont Morgan for his International Mercantile Marine Company, the IMM. Ismay retained the role of managing director and in 1904 became president of the IMM. However, the story starts in earnest in September 1907. For many years, Cunard had been owners of the largest and fastest vessels afloat. Angry at having lost the coveted Blue Riband Speed Trophy in 1897 to the German liner Kaiser Wilhelm der Grosse, which was also the largest ship afloat, they made an arrangement with the British government to construct two new liners. The Admiralty was concerned at the American takeover of White Star, as it potentially prevented commandeering their ships in time of war. Therefore, the new liners, Lusitania and Mauritania, were to become armed merchant cruisers if the need arose. With the September maiden voyage of Lusitania, now the world's largest and fastest liner, White Star was at a great disadvantage and threatened to lose its best clientele to Cunard, along with a significant portion of the lucrative emigrant trade. That year, the chairman of Harland & Wolff, William Peary, invited Ismay and his wife to dinner at his Belgrave house. Conversation turned to Lusitania and the difficulties Cunard posed to their companies. There was only one option, to create a new liner. Realistically, they couldn't compete in terms of speed, so they turned to size, luxury, and safety. The evening drew to a close with preliminary sketches, and to emphasise their great scale, appropriate names were chosen from Greek mythology, arguably directly competing with Cunard's use of Roman province names. From the Olympians came Olympic, the Titans, Titanic, and the Gigantes, Gigantic. It soon became apparent that Harland & Wolff, in its current state, was not capable of constructing them. The proposed dimensions of the class were substantially larger than their biggest slipway. Therefore, the yard immediately began a massive redevelopment project. Three slipways at the Queen's Island area were demolished and rebuilt as two. Atop of this, a massive construction scaffolding to carry cranes and provide multi-level access was assembled by the Owl Company. In addition, a new dry dock was built, the largest in the world, capable of holding 21 million gallons of water. Finally, Southampton and New York required new docks and piers for the liners to moor. With this necessary infrastructure completed, construction could begin in earnest. The Olympic class design was one of both tradition and modernity. At 882 feet 9 inches long, with a beam of 92.5 feet, they stood 175 feet tall from keel to funnels. They were to be powered by 29 boilers, feeding two four-storey reciprocating engines, venting into an ahead-only central turbine, collectively operating three propellers. Their steam engines and outer propellers still remain the largest of their type ever fitted to a ship. They only required three funnels. However, it was decided to add a dummy fourth in order to suggest that they would be as powerful as other four funnellers of the time. No wonder that they were considered almost monstrous. Having 10 decks in total, plus a double bottom, they were divided from bow to stern with 15 transverse bulkheads. They were designed so that any two adjoining compartments, or either the first four or last three compartments, could be flooded with no risk to the vessel, something unprecedented in ship design, one breached compartment usually being sufficient to sink the average vessel. In addition, they had the most powerful wireless sets of any vessel afloat, with a range of over 400 miles. They were subdivided into the three classes of the day. Steerage, third class, was comparatively utilitarian and located towards the bow and stern. Second class primarily occupied the area under the third and fourth funnels and was considered better than first class on many other ships. First class was primarily located under the forward two funnels and had the greatest luxury. In addition to the ornate dining rooms, smoking rooms and lounge, the Olympic class provided an a la carte restaurant, electric lifts, a squash court and a Turkish bath, and were amongst the first vessels to have a swimming pool and gymnasium. However, the focal point was the grand staircase, sporting a decorative clock entitled Honour and Glory Crowning Time. Olympic's keel was laid on number 2 slip on the 16th of December 1908, with Titanic's on number 3 slip on the 31st of March 1909. Leading the design team were Alexander Carlyle and Thomas Andrews. Constructed simultaneously, there were occasional misfortunes. 9 people were killed during Olympic's construction and 8 with Titanic's. The yard were surprised, as shipbuilding usually led to greater deaths than this, it often being claimed that for every £10,000 spent there would be a fatality. The cost of Olympic and Titanic was £1.5 million each, approximately £85,590,000 today. Olympic was launched on the 20th of October 1910 amid great publicity. Painted grey to aid press photographers, her launch took the size record from Mauritania, and as such, there was major interest in the new liner, not least from the shipbuilding community. In 1911, the Shipbuilder Journal published a special edition on the two new vessels, concentrating on their design and construction. When referring to one of their safety features, the watertight doors, they stated, quote, "Each door is held in the open position by a suitable friction clutch, which can be instantly released by means of a powerful electromagnet controlled from the captain's bridge, so that in the event of accident, or at any time when it may be considered advisable, the captain can, by simply moving an electric switch, instantly close the doors throughout and make the vessel practically unsinkable." The press read this and subsequently dropped the "practically," and so a legend was born, one that Holland and Wolfe and White Star did little to counter. A proposed but never released brochure reading, quote, "As far as it is possible to do so, these two wonderful vessels are designed to be unsinkable." The class's davits, specially designed by the Welin Davit Company, could hold 4 lifeboats each, making a total of 64 boats. However, the legislation concerning lifeboat provision had only last been updated in 1894. It linked lifeboat numbers to overall tonnage. Vessels over 10,000 tonnes were to have 16 lifeboats. Olympic and Titanic were 45,000 tonnes each. Carlyle wanted 64 boats, but Ismay and Piri saw no need. They were lifeboats in their own right. They also noted that filling the decks with lifeboats would be unsightly and display a lack of confidence in their own vessels. In 1910, Carlyle resigned, Andrews becoming chief designer. It was decided that the class would have 16 lifeboats to comply with regulations, and an additional 4 Engelhardt collapsible lifeboats, making a total of 20. Titanic was launched on the 31st of May 1911. White Star never christened their vessels, so with little ceremony, she slid into Balagan. As one Harland and Wolff worker stated, quote, "We just builds them and shoves them in." Once the 62-second launch was complete, signal rockets were fired spelling success. During the launch, a worker called James Dobbins was struck by falling timber and died later that day, putting the total dead to 9. Olympic was handed over to White Star the same day, commencing her maiden voyage on the 14th of June 1911 to New York. Her commander was Captain Edward John Smith, Commodore of the White Star. He was highly skilled and very popular, many millionaires changing their travel plans in order to sail with him. When once asked of his career, he replied, quote, "When anyone asks how I can best describe my experience in nearly 40 years at sea, I merely say, uneventful. Of course there have been winter gales and storms and fog for like, but in all my experience, I have never been in any accident of any sort worth speaking about. I never saw a wreck and never have been wrecked, nor was I ever in any predicament that threatened to end in disaster of any sort. You see, I am not very good material for a story." On the 20th of September 1911, Olympic was en route to Cherbourg and crossing the Solent with Smith and pilot George Boyer on the bridge. Leaving the naval base, HMS Hawke drew alongside nearby. Suddenly, she swerved into the aft starboard quarter of Olympic, puncturing her hull and damaging a propeller. Hawke had her bow crushed. Olympic shortly returned to Belfast for repairs, and work on Titanic stopped. The inquiry placed the blame for the accident on Olympic, as her engines literally sucked the smaller warship into her side. However, White Star was able to recover the negative publicity by using the incident as a demonstration of how safe the class was, as Hawk had a ram bow designed to sink vessels and had struck a bulkhead, thus flooding two compartments. In February 1912, Olympic returned to Belfast again with a thrown propeller blade, and again work halted on Titanic. As with all new ships, there were teething troubles. In Olympic's case, the two main issues were the underuse of the B-deck promenade and that spray often soaked the forward A-deck promenade. Modifications were thus made to Titanic, the main two being that her forward A-deck promenade was enclosed and her B-deck promenade was replaced with additional cabins, parlour suites with her own private promenades and a Café Parisien. These increased her tonnage, making Titanic the largest vessel afloat and giving her distinguishing marks from Olympic. Olympic had received much publicity, but it was Titanic, especially after these modifications, which had rising fame in the press as a marvel of the age. However, in spite of the noticeable visual differences between the sisters, due to their close similarity, many images of Olympic were, and still are, labelled as Titanic. Titanic's maiden voyage had ultimately been put back to the 10th of April 1912. And on the 2nd of April, she sailed into the Irish Sea for her trials, which due to bad weather delaying their start, took less than 24 hours. All tests were passed and the Board of Trade certified her seaworthy. Under the temporary command of Captain Herbert Haddock, she arrived at Southampton at midnight on the 3rd of April and proceeded to load provisions and hire crew members. On the 10th of April, Captain Smith arrived at his new command, as he always took the maiden voyages of the company's new ships. It is believed that he intended to retire after the crossing. Previously, Smith had ordered a reshuffle of officers, requesting Henry Wilde as chief officer from Olympic. As a result, intended second officer, David Blair, was taken off the crew and left behind. William Murdoch became first officer instead of chief. Charles Lightoller, second officer instead of first. Herbert Pittman, third. Joseph Boxall, fourth. Harold Lowe, fifth. And James Moody, sixth. Hugh McElroy was the purser, and Joseph Bell, chief engineer. Employed by the Moconi Company were wireless men Jack Phillips and Harold Bride, who were employed to send and receive passenger telegrams. Also aboard were Ismay, who frequently sailed on maiden voyages, and Andrews with the Guarantee Gang from Harland and Wolff. However, there was already a problem. Coal. Shortly before she was set to depart, a large miners' strike led to a lack of coal for steamships, with many being laid up in Southampton. As Titanic's departure was to be headline news, and as it was estimated that she would use over 600 tonnes daily, her coal was taken off other company ships to fill her bunkers, with one catching fire in the process. At 8 a.m. on the 10th, there was a very brief boat drill for the crew, and from 9:30 a.m, the special boat train started arriving and passengers began to board. Tickets varied in price according to class and cabin location. The first class millionaire suites cost £850 one way, approximately £48,501 today. The cheapest first class ticket was £26, now £1,483. Second class was on average £13, equivalent to £741 today, and third class was £9, today £513. This was in a time when the average unskilled emigrant's wage was less than £1 a week. That's under £57 today. Boarding at Southampton were 922 passengers, including William Stead, the journalist, Major Archibald Butt, military aide to President Taft, and Isidore and Ida Strauss, owners of Macy's department store. Some passengers, mostly second class, were taken off other vessels stranded in Southampton. There was some concern lest anything would go wrong, but as a crewman said to Mrs. Sylvia Caldwell, quote, "God himself could not sink this ship." At 12 p.m, Titanic started her maiden voyage. Passing the line of moored ships, Smith oversaw pilot Boyer, who had previously caused the Hawk incident on Olympic. Suddenly, there was a crack, shouting and running about. The liner New York was moored nearby, and the suction from Titanic's engines snapped her mooring lines like threads. As the vessel swung towards Titanic, Smith set the port engine full astern, preventing a collision by mere yards. The tug Vulcan slipped off Titanic and took the New York out of the way as Titanic started again. Her first port of call was Cherbourg, where she arrived at 6:30 p.m. She was too large to enter the port, so moored at sea, while 274 passengers, mail and cargo, were transferred aboard by the tenders Nomadic and Traffic, with 22 disembarking. Of those taken by Nomadic, built specially to service the Olympic class, and now the last White Star vessel left, were Colonel John Jacob Astor IV, owner of the Waldorf Astoria and his wife, Benjamin Guggenheim, the businessman, Margaret Molly Brown, the socialite, and Sir Cosmo Duff Gordon, 5th Baronet of Halkin, and his wife Lucille, a famed fashion designer. Her final stop before crossing the Atlantic was Queenstown, Ireland. Arriving at 11:30 a.m. on the 11th of April, again mooring out to sea, the last 120 passengers, mostly emigrants, and mail were brought aboard, with 7 disembarking, making a complement of 1,343 passengers and 885 crew, a total of 2,228 on board. From the 11th to the 13th, Titanic covered 905 miles at almost top speed, sailing in fine weather. While ships only used wireless to deliver private messages, there was a common courtesy of passing ice warnings from ship to ship. At 10:30 p.m. on the 13th, the first message came in by Morse lamp of heavy pack ice from SS Rappahannock, which had sustained minor damage while passing through it. Titanic's wireless broke down that evening. Phillips and Bride repaired it, against regulations, but had a large backlog of messages to send. On Sunday the 14th of April, Titanic received more warnings of ice ahead. Divine service was held that morning and ironically concluded with the hymn, "For Those in Peril on the Sea." Further warnings indicated much field ice and that it was progressing more southerly than usual. A message from the Baltic warned of ice 250 miles ahead of Titanic. Smith showed the message to Ismay, who pocketed it, later showing it to some passengers, while reassuring them that they would pass through the ice at full steam to avoid any danger. Eventually, Smith asked for it back, and it was posted in the bridge, several hours after being received. Concerning Ismay's comments, many believe that Ismay ordered Smith to increase speed. The point is still strongly debated. However, there are numerous points that technically nullify this argument. Firstly, Ismay as a passenger would have had no control over Smith as captain while at sea. Secondly, a stoker later stated at the inquiry that he saw no light at all in boiler room 1. The boilers were unlit and not being used. Therefore, she couldn't have been going at the fastest possible speed, which might have damaged the new engines in any event. Thirdly, there's the question of why go faster? Although earlier there had been impetus to empty the bunker in boiler room 6 that had been on fire. This was effectively put out by this point, although causing some warping of the bulkhead. There was no chance of breaking any speed records. It would be uneconomic with coal. And had they arrived early, the press wouldn't have been there, and Ellis Island immigration would have been closed, meaning everyone would have had to have remained on board in any event. Finally, they were sailing a slightly longer route, as at 5:50 p.m. Smith ordered a southern course to be taken, probably to avoid the reported pack ice. At 7:30 p.m, 3 messages were intercepted from the Californian reporting large icebergs. At 8:55, Smith excused himself from a dinner party and returned to the bridge, discussing with Lightoller the weather and its impact on iceberg visibility. The evening was calm and clear. Lightoller later said it was, quote, like a mill pond. This meant there would be no spray or breaking waves at an iceberg's base, and with no moon, there would be no reflection either. At 9:20 p.m, Smith retired for the night, ordering to be woken, quote, if it becomes at all doubtful. Shortly afterwards, Lightoller sent word to the lookouts to keep a sharp watch for ice. At 9:40 p.m, the last complete ice warning was received from the Mesaba. It was never delivered to the bridge. At 10 p.m, Lightoller was relieved by Murdoch, while the lookouts were relieved by Frederick Fleet and Reginald Lee, who were told of Lightoller's earlier order to keep an eye out for ice. They had no binoculars. David Blair had unwittingly taken the key for the locker with him when disembarking in Southampton. At 10:55 p.m, the Leyland Line ship Californian, also part of Morgan's IMM, found itself in the ice field between 10 and 19 miles north of Titanic. As it sent ice warnings to all nearby ships, the sensitivity of Titanic's set caused the Californian's message to override the private message Phillips was transmitting, and was so loud that it blasted in his ears. Crossly, he replied, "Keep out, shut up, you're jamming my signal, I'm working Cape Race." Californian's Marconi man, Cyril Evans, was offended, and at 11:30 p.m. decided to shut down for the night, his daily duties complete. Excuse me. With First Officer Murdoch in command, 6th Officer Moody assisting, Quartermaster Robert Hitchens at the wheel, and lookouts Fleet and Lee in the crow's nest, Titanic steamed forth at 21 knots. It was 11:40 p.m. Peering ahead, Fleet spotted a dark shape against the black sky, 500 yards and closing. He rang the ship's bell 3 times and picked up the phone to the bridge. Moody answered, "What did you see?" "Iceberg right ahead." "Thank you." Murdoch shouted over to Hitchens, "Hard astarboard," and ran to the engine telegraphs, ordering full astern. He closed all watertight doors. Titanic gradually edged to port and slowed very slightly, but it wasn't enough. Broken ice from the berg fell onto the forward well deck, and as Murdoch ordered hard a port to swing around the iceberg, it drifted along the starboard side and out of sight. 47 seconds had elapsed since it was sighted. The force of the collision varied on where you were on the ship. Fleet and Lee were relieved about the near miss. Boxall was walking along the starboard A deck, and the collision didn't even interrupt his stride. The iceberg was so small that he failed to see it pass right by him. According to Fleet, it only reached as high as the forecastle, thus being barely 60 foot tall. Some felt a gentle rumble, although most only realised something was afoot when the engine stopped. In third class and the crew's quarters, it was much more noticeable as the ship shook and people were thrown out of bed. However, there was little concern. For example, some third class passengers congregated on the forward well deck and actually started playing football with broken pieces of ice. Smith rushed to the bridge almost immediately. What did we hit? Murdoch explained. Smith then sent for Andrews and requested him, Boxall and the carpenter to sound the ship for damage. The first six compartments were flooding, including boiler room 6, and boiler room 5 was also taking a minor amount of water, collectively at a rate faster than the pumps could manage, over 7 tons of water per second. Weighed down by the head, the watertight bulkheads didn't reach up to the watertight C deck, allowing water to flow over their tops into undamaged compartments. In around 2 hours, Titanic would founder. Now, one of the greatest misconceptions surrounding the disaster is actually what damage was done. Newspapers of the day reasoned that for an unsinkable ship to sink in what appeared to be such little time, there had to be a tremendous amount of damage. Illustrations of the day showed a great gash in her side. But one man argued against popular opinion. Harland and Wolff architect Edward Wilding noticed that accounts of flooding stated different levels in each compartment. He calculated that this was due to differing amounts of damage, as opposed to a continuous tear, and therefore that the actual amount need not be particularly large, no more than 12 square feet. He put this forward at the inquiry, but was generally ignored. However, in 1996, an expedition used sonar to locate the now buried collision damage. A further expedition aimed to locate damage that, according to leading fireman Fred Barrett, literally opened up in front of him in boiler room 6. They found it, just above the silt. This small split, as with the others, is not a gash made by the iceberg tearing into her side, but minuscule gaps between hull plates caused by the iceberg grinding along her side, buckling her plates and popping rivets. There have been recent claims that she was sunk due to poor riveting. This was one of only two main areas aboard where they were fitted by hand instead of hydraulically. However, while a few rivets have shown high levels of sulphurous slag, the majority of rivets were perfectly strong. At one point in the wreck, there is now a 180-degree bend in the hull plating, with no failures or fractures. The sum total of the damage sustained is as follows. A trace amount in the four-peak tank, a 5-foot gap and a 4-foot gap in hold 1, a 15-foot gap on the next bulkhead extending into hold 2, a 32-foot gap across hold 3, and a 45-foot gap across boiler room 6 running into the bunker for boiler room 5. The average height of each split is barely 5 millimetres. This tiny damage is hardly the 300-foot gash predicted. Wilding was right. Ismay noticed the collision and came to the bridge, being informed of the situation. Lightoller was placed in charge of swinging out the port lifeboats, Murdoch for the starboard boats, while the remainder were given various jobs. Bride had just taken over from Phillips when Smith ordered them to prepare to send the International Call for Distress, CQD. Boxall calculated their position, although in 1985 it was found this was out by 13.5 miles. Many first and second class passengers were unaware of what was happening, only that it had to be significant, as the engines had stopped and the safety valves were lifting to reduce steam pressure, causing a tremendous noise of escaping steam. Third class, however, had a better idea, as water slowly inched up the walls of their cabins. Shortly after 12 a.m, the 15th of April, postal staff trying to move mail to higher ground became trapped and drowned, the first fatalities. By 12.05, the order to start bringing passengers, initially first class, on deck was given. Many of the officers realised that the lifeboats provided spaces for barely 1,178 of the 2,228 aboard. Between 12.15am and 2.17am, the distress calls were heard by numerous vessels, most being between 49 and 253 miles away. Sadly, the farthest away at 500 miles was Olympic. On the Californian, Second Officer Herbert Stone was watching the lights of a steamship that he and Captain Stanley Lord had sighted earlier. It looked as if she had also stopped, and they believed she was a similar-sized vessel to them. They tried contacting it with a Morse lamp, but received no reply. At 12:20 a.m, the order was given to start filling the lifeboats, women and children first. Murdoch, in charge of the starboard boats, took this to mean that any remaining spaces were to be given to men. Lightoller, to port, assumed it meant women and children only. The ship's band, led by violinist Wallace Hartley, started to play ragtime in the first-class lounge, later moving up to the boat deck. At 12:25 a.m, Harold Cotton, the Marconi man on RMS Carpathia of the Cunard line, was undressing for bed, but happened to have his headphones still on. He was contacted by Cape Cod, stating that there were messages queuing up for Titanic. Contacting her, he stated, "I say, old man, do you know there is a batch of messages coming through for you from Cape Cod?" Phillips replied, "CQD, we have struck a berg. It's a CQD, old man." Shocked, he asked, "Shall I tell my captain? Do you require assistance?" "Yes, come quick." Captain Arthur Rostron ordered full steam to assist, ordering unnecessary systems, such as heating, shut down to conserve steam. Cotton informed Phillips that with a top speed of 14 knots, they would traverse the 58 miles in 4 hours. 12:45 a.m. Murdoch lowered the first lifeboat, number 7, on the starboard side. Designed to accommodate 65, it left with 28, as many refused to board it. Not only was the drop from the boat deck to the sea so far that the water was barely visible, but many believed it far better to be in a large, brightly lit ship than in a small rowing boat in the Atlantic. Women refused to leave their husbands. After all, Titanic was unsinkable. At the same time, Boxall fired the first of 8 distress rockets. He saw a vessel some miles away and attempted to contact it with Morse lamp, but it appeared to sail away. On the Californian, Stone noticed the mystery ship appeared to be firing rockets. Unsure, he woke Captain Lord and described what he saw. Lord replied that they were probably company signal rockets, not all ships having a wireless set. Later, Stone informed Lord that the unknown vessel appeared to have sailed away. Lord's actions are probably the most contested aspect of the disaster. Ultimately blamed for not sailing to assist, Lord's reputation was ruined. However, in recent years, and since the discovery of the wreck, it was found that Boxall's position was slightly off. There was also argument about whether the correct type of rockets were used. They were white instead of red. Conversely, there is another explanation. While distances are sketchy, it appears that Titanic saw a ship roughly 5 miles away that sailed away. Californian saw a ship roughly 5 miles away that sailed away. Ultimately, Californian found Titanic sank roughly 10 miles away, and both ships had been stationary. It is now believed by some that a ship called the Samson that was illegally sealing was between the two vessels. With no wireless and thinking the rockets belonged to the authorities, they sailed away. While Phillips sent distress calls, Bride took replies to Smith, at one point joking to Phillips, quote, "Send SOS, it's the new call. It may be your last chance to send it." They did not send history's first SOS. That title, it is believed, went to SS Arafo in 1909. Instead, they interspersed SOS with CQD in all their messages after 12:45 a.m. The first SOS from Titanic was received by Olympic. At 12:55 a.m, lifeboat number 6 on the port side was lowered by Lightoller with 28 aboard, including Molly Brown, Fleet, and Hitchens as tillerman. Later, Smith would call them back as they were half empty, but Hitchens refused to turn around. Also at 12:55, starboard number 5 was lowered by Lowe, with 36 aboard, being commanded by Pittman. Ismay tried to encourage women to board lifeboats, with one later stating that she owed her life to him. However, in his panicked attempt to assist, he repeatedly told Lowe to lower away. Lowe lost patience and told his employer, quote, "You want me to lower away quickly? You'll have me drown the whole lot of them." By now, some passengers noticed a slight incline to the previously level deck. Down below, Barrett and the stokers were busy manning the pumps and drawing the fires to prevent any boiler explosions. But there was little they could do other than continue trying to generate power for the lights and wireless. At 1 a.m, starboard lifeboat number 3 was launched with 32 aboard. As women were refusing to board, Murdoch allowed 10 stokers in it. 10 minutes later, starboard number 1 was lowered. Capable of holding 40 people, it carried only 12. Of these, 7 were crewmen, and 5 were first-class passengers, notably Sir Cosmo and Lady Duff Gordon and their secretary. At the same time, port number 8 left the ship with 39 people. Interestingly, considering the significance of class and gender in the era, the lifeboat was steered by the Countess of Rothes. By 1:15 a.m, the mood began to change. There was now a noticeable list to port, and the decks were becoming ever increasingly steeper. More people started to board the 14 remaining lifeboats. Roughly at this point, the first third-class passengers were coming up to the boat deck, although no specific orders to allow them up had been given. At 1:20 a.m, starboard number 9 was lowered with 56 aboard, followed by port number 10 with 35, one of the first lifeboats to leave with third-class passengers. These included the Dean family, who were emigrating to Kansas. 9-week-old Milvina was Titanic's youngest passenger and would become the last survivor of the disaster. Titanic was now listing to starboard, as port number 12 was lowered at 1:25 a.m, with 40 occupants. By 1:30, there were noticeable signs of panic amongst some of the passengers. Several were about to jump into the full and half-lowered port number 14, but Lowe fired shots into the air to warn them off. Phillips's messages started becoming more desperate, telling Olympic, "We are putting passengers off in small boats. Women and children in boats cannot last much longer." 1:35 a.m. Starboard number 13 and 15 were launched almost simultaneously, with 64 and 65 aboard respectively. As number 15 neared the water, number 13 drifted under it, still attached to the falls. Barrett, who was commanding number 13, called up to stop lowering, but wasn't heard. A passenger managed to cut them free moments before number 15 would have crushed them. While this was occurring, port number 16 was swung out, with over 50 aboard. Excuse me. As the forward well deck began to submerge, her propellers began to rise out of the water, while those watching from the lifeboats could discern the dim lights of portholes slowly disappearing under the sea. At 1:40 a.m, collapsible boat C was about to be lowered when a 47th occupant boarded, Bruce Ismay. In an action that would destroy his reputation, Ismay left Titanic in unknown circumstances. Coming close to a breakdown and later requiring sedation, he could not remember how he departed, other than that there were no women near the collapsible. Films popularly portray him as sneaking into the boat, but witnesses claim to have seen an officer, possibly Wilde, literally bundle him in. Period American newspapers were anti-upper-class Englishmen, so painted a black picture of him, nicknaming him J. Brute Ismay. Ismay was a passenger and deeply disturbed by the events unfurling around him, so much so that he couldn't bear to turn and see his ship sink. However, Senator William Smith, whom I shall come to later, ultimately declared him innocent of any wrongdoing, while Lord Mersey concluded that, quote, "Had he not jumped in, he would merely have added one more life, namely his own, to the number of those lost." Nonetheless, the press's negative viewpoint is what the public remembers, so Ismay effectively became another scapegoat. At 1:45 a.m, Carpathia received the last message from Titanic, although other ships were still picking up transmissions. Port number 2 was lowered with 25 people under the command of Boxhall. Simultaneously, starboard number 11 was launched with 70 aboard, actually overloaded. At 1:55 a.m, J.J. Astor asked Lightoller if he could join his pregnant wife in port number 4. Lightoller refused, and the boat left with 32 people. With only 3 collapsible lifeboats left, each capable of holding only 47 people, the officers feared a rush. Lightoller made crew members form a circle around collapsible D, allowing only women and children through. Lowered with 24 aboard, he had to fire his revolver in the air to warn people off. With water less than 10 feet from A-deck, her forecastle went under. Around this time, Hartley, a devout Methodist, and his band started playing "Nearer My God to Thee." At 2:10 a.m, Captain Smith went to the Marconi room and relieved Phillips and Bride of their duties, but they continued calling for assistance. At 2:17 a.m, SS Virginian heard CQ and it cut off, the final transmission from Titanic. With water flowing into the bridge, they left the wireless room, Bride assisting with moving collapsible B from the port officer's quarters roof and Phillips heading aft. Collapsible B fell upside down onto the boat deck. Captain Smith called out, "Every man for himself," and was last seen walking to the bridge. Thomas Andrews was seen alone in the first class smoking room, staring at a painting of the approach to Plymouth Harbour. At 2:17 a.m, she made a sudden plunge, submerging the bridge and causing the first funnel to collapse, its wash making collapsible B float free, still upside down. Collapsible A also floated free, but was swamped and in danger of sinking, its 20 or so occupants standing in icy water. At such an angle as to make the bulkheads useless, Titanic started her death throes. At 2:18 a.m, Titanic's stern cleared the water, and all aboard scrambled for her aftermost deck. At the end of the boat deck, Father Thomas Biles heard confession for second and third class passengers. Her lights flashed once, then were extinguished. A rumbling crash echoed around. Many believed it was her boilers breaking free, but in reality, her back was broken. She did not attain a now stereotypical steep angle, instead scarcely 12 degrees, and most did not notice her breakup. Settling slightly, the stern flooded almost instantly and reared up to the perpendicular, rotating 180 degrees. Then, at 2:20 a.m, 15th of April, she glided beneath the waves. A voice called out, "She's gone." Only Low, in port number 14, returned to help those in the water, rescuing four, one of whom died. Seven swimmers made it to number four, but two would die. Molly Brown in number six would gain worldwide fame, losing patience with Hitchens, threatening to throw him overboard and encouraging the female occupants to help row. Collapsible B remained afloat with 30 people standing on its upturned hull, including Lightoller and Bride. Low took off survivors, but up to half of them were already dead. Survivors in Collapsible A were also picked up, with three further fatalities. At 3:30 a.m, Carpathia came into view, having sailed to them at 17 knots, 3 knots more than her design speed. Leaving the area at 8:50 a.m. for New York, Bride assisted Cotton with transmitting messages, even though he was suffering from severe frostbite. Among the lost were Captain Smith, Chief Officer Wild, First Officer Murdoch, Sixth Officer Moody, Purser McElroy, Chief Engineer Bell, Jack Phillips, Thomas Andrews, Wallace Hartley and his band, William Stead, Major Archibald Butt, Isidore and Ida Strauss, who chose to remain together, J.J. Astor, and Benjamin Guggenheim, probably most famous for his last words, "We are dressed in our best and are prepared to go down as gentlemen." On the 17th of April, White Star hired the McKay Bennett to recover bodies. Next day, the Carpathia arrived in New York. She lowered Titanic's lifeboats in the White Star berth, then proceeded to Cunard Pier 54 to offload survivors. The disaster was one of the first international media sensations, one of the reasons for its fame now. There was overwhelming grief and a demand to know what caused the sinking and such poor provision of lifeboats. The Titanic Disaster Relief Fund was established to aid those who had lost everything. For example, the male population of Southampton was decimated. In one school, 120 children lost their fathers. Wallace Hartley was deemed a hero. His body was the only one repatriated. For his funeral, his hometown's population tripled, with people coming to pay their respects. There were two inquiries into the disaster, one by the US Senate and another by the English Board of Trade. The former lasted from the 19th of April to the 25th of May, chaired by Senator William Smith. The British inquiry lasted from the 2nd of May to the 3rd of July. Chaired by Rec Commissioner Lord Mersey, it is now considered a whitewash, as it was the Board of Trade who had led to the lifeboat situation in the first place. The inquiries mostly concentrated on how events unfurled, bringing in both experts and survivors to explain, most frequently Ismay. Regulations were modified so that all ships would have sufficient lifeboats for everyone aboard. Additionally, 24-hour wireless operation was made compulsory, and the International Ice Patrol was founded in 1913 to chart the position of icebergs and warn vessels. Finally, the first International Convention for the Safety of Life at Sea was held as a result in 1914, making many of these recommendations international law. SOLAS, as it is called, is still in use as the premier treaty on safety regulations at sea. Finally, the inquiries estimated the total loss. In first class, 57 men were saved, 118 lost. 140 women saved, 4 lost. Officially, no children were lost in first or second class. 14 second-class men were saved, 154 lost. 80 women survived, 13 lost. In third class, 75 men survived, 387 lost. 76 women saved, 89 lost. 27 children were saved, 52 lost. Of the crew, 212 were saved, 696 lost. In total, 705 survived, 1,523 were lost. Only 328 bodies were recovered, most being buried in Halifax, Nova Scotia. White Star now had two large problems, Olympic and Gigantic, whose keel was laid on the 30th of November 1911. Olympic had already had one voyage cancelled due to a mass stoker's mutiny, refusing to sail on a ship with insufficient lifeboats. It was decided to modify them, rectifying all issues raised in the inquiries. Gigantic was renamed Britannic and had further modifications. Additional stern decks and large gantry davits capable of lowering multiple lifeboats simultaneously. Launched on the 26th of February 1914 as the largest vessel afloat, White Star hoped that she could rectify the bad publicity of Titanic. But it was not to be. The Great War decimated shipping, with Lusitania, Californian and Carpathia all ultimately being victims. At its start, the two sisters were called up. Olympic became a troop transport, while the still incomplete Britannic became a hospital ship under the command of Captain Charles Bartlett. Both saw active service, Olympic rescuing the crew of HMS Audacious after striking a mine, and being the only merchantman in the war to sink an armed enemy when she ran over U-boat U-103. Meanwhile, Britannic assisted at Gallipoli with five successful voyages, repatriating wounded soldiers. On the 12th of November 1916, His Majesty's hospital ship Britannic departed Southampton on her sixth voyage for the island of Lemnos in the Aegean Sea, with 1,066 crew and nursing personnel aboard, arriving at Naples for refuelling on the 17th. After a brief delay due to a storm, she entered the Kia Channel early Tuesday the 21st of November. At 8:12 a.m, there was an explosion. It was believed to be either a torpedo or a mine, and has now been confirmed as a mine led by U-73 and Capitan Lieutenant Gustav Sies. Her hull was ruptured between holds 2 and 3 on the starboard side. However, the force of the explosion had damaged bulkheads and jammed several watertight doors, causing flooding in all of the first six compartments. Post-Titanic, this was the new maximum that she could sustain and survive. However, many portholes had been opened by nurses who found their Atlantic cabins too stuffy for the Mediterranean climate. Her forward momentum forced water in, and as she listed, more portholes submerged. It was quickly realised that she would founder. Through this action, all of her safety devices were nullified. As Britannic was sinking rapidly, Bartlett decided to try and beach her on the nearby island of Kia, so ordered full ahead and attempted to turn her while transmitting distress signals. Simultaneously, officers and crew began preparing the lifeboats, awaiting the order to lower them. Amid the panic, some had already been half lowered. After a few minutes, the order to wait was given. However, two lifeboats were launched without the knowledge of the officer in control due to automatic release gear. Nurse Violet Jessop was in one when it fell 6 feet into the water. I'm surprised to find herself almost alone in it. Quote, "Every man Jack in the group of surrounding boats took a flying leap into the sea. They came thudding from behind and all around me, taking to the water like a vast army of rats. I turned around to see the reason for this exodus and, to my horror, saw Britannic's huge propellers churning and mincing up everything near them. Men, boats and everything were just one ghastly whirl." Jessop passed through the spinning blades as the lifeboat was torn apart. She survived with only a broken skull. Amazingly, she'd been a stewardess on Olympic when she struck HMS Hawk and had survived Titanic sinking too. 30 other occupants of the lifeboats weren't as fortunate. Bartlett recognised the risk and that she was shipping more water, so ordered all stop, the propeller stopping just before a third lifeboat was sucked in. At 8:35 a.m, he ordered abandon ship. At 9:07, she rolled over to starboard and foundered. She took only 55 minutes to go down. 1,036 survivors, including Captain Bartlett, were rescued by local fishermen and HM ships Scourge and Heroic. Although the largest vessel lost in the Great War and a hospital ship, there was little media interest after the first few days, being yet another casualty of the war. Olympic transported 201,000 troops, earning the nickname of Old Reliable. In 1919, she was refitted, one of the first liners to be converted from coal to oil firing. She returned to her Atlantic crossings, carrying numerous celebrities, such as Charlie Chaplin, and various royals. She was involved in a couple more incidents, most serious being colliding with a Nantucket lightship in fog in 1934, sinking the smaller wooden vessel with a loss of seven lives. In 1934, White Star merged with Cunard. Olympic was now comparatively elderly, and in 1935 was withdrawn from service. Sold to Sir John Jarvis for £100,000, she last sailed under her own steam to Jarrow to be demolished, providing jobs for the area during the Depression. One of her final lookouts was Frederick Fleet. All her interiors were stripped out and sold at auction, many remaining today, notably at the White Swan Hotel in Alnwick. In 1947, Cunard bought out the remainder of White Star, and the company ceased to exist. That would be the end of the story, were it not for Titanic. In 1985, Dr. Robert Ballard of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute was ordered by the American Navy to record two Cold War submarine wrecks and was permitted as a cover story to use any spare time to search for Titanic. Working with a French team, on the 1st of September, a wreck was located. Subsequent expeditions have recorded the wreck's condition, identified many aspects of the disaster, and have recovered thousands of artifacts. Many questions were answered by her discovery, and many more raised, continually helping fuel public interest. There's a Belfast saying, Titanic was not a disaster, what happened to her was. Last year, at the centenary of her launch, people celebrated. This year, today, 100 years after those 2.5 hours in April, it is time to reflect and remember. The fate that befell Titanic means that the Olympic class will never be forgotten. But why all this fame? Titanic was never the worst maritime disaster in history. However, she was the first major disaster to be covered by international media. Her story has all the perfect ingredients, rich and poor, famous and obscure, arrogance and horror. It was an extreme case of pride coming before a fall, mankind's greatest achievement falling victim to one of nature's simplest entities. Titanic was a symbol of the future, social, technological, but also quite literally a symbol of hope for those seeking a new life overseas. Faith, however, was shattered. Not just faith in technology, but in a more general sense. Titanic heralded a change in era, the end of confidence and the start of more troubling times. To quote survivor Jack Fayer, "There was peace and the world had an even tenor to its way. Nothing was revealed in the morning, the trend of which was not known the night before. It seems to me that the disaster about to occur was the event that not only made the world rub its eyes and awake, but woke it with a start, keeping it moving at a rapidly accelerating pace ever since, with less and less peace, satisfaction, and happiness. To my mind, the world of today awoke April 15th, 1912. Thank you.
This event was recorded live on the 9th of March 2012 at the National Archives, Kew. This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.